Okay, imagine a scenario for a second. Close your eyes if you're not driving, obviously.
And yes, please.
You're walking into a patient's room on the oncology floor. It's, I don't know, a Tuesday afternoon. Sunlight is streaming in. And it actually looks kind of peaceful.
A rare moment on a busy floor.
Totally. The patient is sitting up in bed, maybe scrolling on their phone, reading a magazine. They're hooked up to an IV, getting their scheduled chemotherapy infusion.
It's a really common scene. And, you know, a quiet room is usually a good sign.
Right. And you look over to the windowsill, and there's this massive, gorgeous vase of fresh flowers that a family member just dropped off. Lilies, roses, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at their lunch tray, and there's a crisp, fresh apple sitting there. To the average person, even to a brand new nursing student, sometimes this just looks like a healing environment. It looks like love.
But if you are prepping for the NCLEX, you have to strip away that sentimentality. You have to look at that room with a completely different set of eyes.
The safety set of eyes.
Exactly. That isn't just room decor. That vase of flowers is, from a nursing safety standpoint, a biological weapon.
That sounds so dramatic, but it's absolutely true. On the exam, that vase of flowers and that fresh apple are immediate red flag safety hazards.
Huge red flag.
Why? Because the most dangerous side effect of cancer treatment isn't the nausea, it isn't the hair loss, it's invisible. It's often silent until it's way, way too late.
We're talking about the immune system completely bottoming out. We are talking about the body losing its ability to fight off even the most microscopic threats.
Welcome back to ConceptCast, the audio mentor voice for nursingnotes.org. I'm your host, and today we are not just memorizing lists. We are, I think, fundamentally rewiring how you look at patient safety.
And I'm here to help connect those dots. Today we are doing a deep dive into adult hematological and oncological disorders. And I want to be super clear. This is all based on our high-yield review notes. We are sticking to exactly what you need to know to pass.
This is a massive category on the NCLEX. It falls squarely under physiological integrity and, of course, safety. And honestly, when you look at the test plan, the exam creators absolutely love this topic.
They really do. And the reason they love it is because it forces you to prioritize. It's not enough to know what cancer is, you know. Anyone can memorize a definition.
Right.
The exam wants to know, can you spot the patient who is about to get a lethal infection? Can you identify the patient who is about to bleed out? Can you catch that silent medical emergency before the patient completely crashes?
So grab your coffee or your water. Mm. We're big on hydration here. You'll soon find out. And let's get into the core content.
Let's do it.
We have to start with a concept that drives almost all safety questions in oncology. I feel like if you understand this one timeline, you can answer half the questions correctly. We're talking about the nadir.
The nadir. It sounds like a supervillain, doesn't it? The nadir is coming. And honestly, in the context of chemotherapy, it kind of is.
So let's unpack that term. What exactly does it mean physiologically?
So nadir literally means the lowest point. In oncology, it's referring to the point of lowest blood cell counts after a chemotherapy treatment.
Okay, but here's the trap students fall into, right? They think the blood counts drop the day you give the chemo.
Right. You hang the bag on Tuesday, so the patient is at their highest risk on Tuesday.
But that's not how it works.
Not at all, and that's a critical point. Chemotherapy targets rapidly dividing cells. But it takes time for the bone marrow to sort of stop producing new cells. And it also takes time for the cells that are already in your circulation to die off naturally.
So the real danger zone isn't immediate.
Exactly. The nadir, the absolute bottom, the danger zone, usually hits about 7 to 10 days after the treatment.
That is such a critical distinction. So you treat them, they might even go home feeling okay.
Yeah.
But a week later, when they're sitting on their couch, their entire internal defense system is collapsing.
Precisely. And when that suppression hits its peak, we call it pancytopenia. Pan meaning all, cyto meaning cells, and penia meaning a lack of. So a reduction in all three major blood cell types.
The big three, white blood cells, platelets, and red blood cells. The NCLEX asks about these constantly, but usually not all at once. They'll give you a scenario that focuses on one.
Right. They want to test your specific knowledge.
So let's break them down, starting with the most lethal one, neutropenia, the low white blood cells.
This is your infection risk, and I need you to write this down, tattoo it on your brain, whatever you need to do. Infection is the number one cause of death in cancer patients.
Not the cancer itself.
Often, no. It's the sepsis that comes after the treatment completely wipes out their immune system.
So on the exam, we're looking at numbers. What number constitutes neutropenia in this context?
You're watching the absolute neutrophil count, the ANC, On the NCLEX, if you see a segmented neutrophil count that's below 18% or just a very low absolute number, alarms should be ringing in your head.
Okay, but here's where it gets really tricky, and I feel like this is where true clinical judgment comes in. When you or I get sick, let's say we get strep throat, what happens?
Oh, we get a fever. A high one, probably. Our throat gets red, swollen. Yeah. Maybe you see some pus on the tonsils. It's obvious you're sick.
Right, and that pus, that inflammation, that's the white blood cells fighting the war.
Exactly. Pus is essentially just dead white blood cells.
No.
Imagine you have no white blood cells.
You can't make pus.
You can't make pus. You can't mount a massive inflammatory response. You don't get the redness. You don't get the swelling. And you don't get that classic high fever.
So the classic signs of infection are just gone. They're invisible.
They are incredibly subtle. And that is why a fever, even a really low-grade one, is a medical emergency in these patients.
Let's define low grade, because in the real world, if my kid has a 99.5 temp, I'm not panicking.
You're not. You're giving them some Tylenol and putting them to bed. But for a chemo patient, 7 to 10 days post-treatment, if they call you and say, I feel a little warm, my temp is 99.5 Fahrenheit, or they just report malaise, that feeling of being generally cruddy, you do not tell them to take a nap.
You tell them to come in.
Immediately. You investigate.
Because their 99.5 might be the physiological equivalent of R103.
Exactly. Their immune system is screaming as loud as it can, but it's just a whisper. That 99.5 might be all the warning you get before they slide into septic shock.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
And it completely explains why the nursing interventions are so incredibly strict.
It does.
This brings us to neutropenic precautions, which brings us right back to our intro scenario. The flowers and the apple. Why are we banning nature from the room?
It comes down to bacteria and fungi. We live in a world that is just surrounded by them. Pseudomonas, Aspergillus, E. coli. For you and me, our neutrophils handle them without us even noticing.
But for a neutropenic patient?
For them, that fresh flower vase is a breeding ground.
It's the standing water, isn't it?
The standing water is a hotel for bacteria like Pseudomonas. And the flowers themselves, the soil they came from. They can harbor fungal spores, like Aspergillus. If the patient inhales that, or if they get a tiny paper cut and some of that bacteria gets in, it can be game over.
And the apple, it looks so healthy, an apple a day and all that.
Well, the skin of raw fruits and vegetables is covered in bacteria from the soil, from handling, from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. You can't scrub it enough to be 100% safe for someone with zero immune system.
So these patients go on what we call a low bacteria diet.
Exactly.
What does that actually look like?
Cooked veggies, canned fruits, maybe thick-skinned fruits that you can peel yourself, like a banana or an orange. But generally, no fresh salads, no unpeeled apples, nothing raw.
And of course, strict hand walking. That's a given.
The strictest.
Yeah.
And a private room is essential. We are protecting them from the world. We sometimes call it reverse isolation or protective isolation.
Right. We're not worried about catching something from them. We are worried about giving something to them.
That's the key.
Are there medications for this? Or do we just have to wrap them in bubble wrap and wait for the bone marrow to wake up?
We can help it along. There are drugs called biological response modifiers. You'll see names on the NCLEX like filgrastim or pegfilgrastim.
Filgrastim. It's a bit of a mouthful.
Think fill. It helps fill the body with neutrophils. These drugs stimulate the bone marrow to pump out white blood cells much faster, which shortens that dangerous duration of neutropenia.
Okay, so that covers the infection arm of the pancytopenia triad. Let's move to the second arm, thrombocytopenia, low platelets.
The risk here is bleeding, pure and simple.
Now, normal platelet count is roughly, 150,000 to 400,000. But the NCLEX usually doesn't make you panic if it's, say, 140,000.
Right. Mildly low is something to watch, but when you see a count drop below 50,000, that's your trigger. That's the magic number where you are initiating bleeding precautions.
And if it drops even lower than that?
If that number plummets below 20,000, now we are in the real danger zone. That is the threshold for spontaneous bleeding risk.
Can you clarify that for us? Does that mean they just bleed if they bump into a table?
It means they might bleed without bumping into anything at all. We're talking about spontaneous brain bleeds, an intracranial hemorrhage, or a spontaneous GI bleed. Their blood just loses the ability to hold itself inside the vessels properly.
So when we see these numbers on a lab report, we go into lockdown mode. Let's talk about the don'ts of bleeding precautions. Because as nurses, we do a lot of things that are pretty invasive.
We do. And with these patients, you have to stop and think before you touch them. You have to consider anything that could cause trauma to the tissue.
You'd be the big ones, the ones the NCLEX loves to test.
Number one, No IM injections. Intramuscular shots go deep into the muscle. If you punch a needle in there and they have no platelets, you can cause a massive hematoma, a big collection of blood deep in the muscle that can be incredibly painful and even dangerous.
What about temperature? We talked about fever being an emergency. How do we take it?
Not rectally. Do not use a rectal thermometer. No suppositories, no enemas, absolutely nothing in the rectum.
Why the specific focus on the rectum?
Because that tissue is extremely fragile and incredibly vascular. It tears so easily. If you cause a micro tear in the rectum of a patient with 10,000 platelets, they can bleed out into their colon and you won't even see it until their blood pressure crashes.
That is a very vivid and scary image. Okay, there's one that always surprises students. Flossing.
Yep. No flossing.
But dental hygiene is important.
It is. But flossing, by its nature, can cut the gums. Even in healthy people, you might see a little pink in the sink after you floss.
Sure.
For these patients, that tiny cut just won't stop bleeding. So we switch them to a soft bristle toothbrush only. Or even those little foam swabs if their gums are really inflamed.
And for shaving. The men who want a clean shave.
Electric razors only. No blades. You absolutely cannot risk a nick.
It really does sound like we're wrapping them in bubble wrap.
That's the goal. And you also need to be constantly assessing for the bleeding you can't see.
Occult bleeding.
Exactly. Assess for hematuria blood in the urine or occult blood in the stool. Just because you don't see bright red blood doesn't mean they aren't losing it slowly.
Is there a medication rescue for low platelets, like filgrastim is for neutrophils?
There is. There's a drug called Oprilvecan. It stimulates platelet production. It's probably not as common on the exam as divlagrastim, but you should definitely recognize the name. And of course, if it's a critical situation, we can just transfuse platelets directly.
Got it. Okay, third and final arm of pancytopenia, anemia, low red blood cells.
This one feels a bit more straightforward to most people, I think. Red blood cells carry oxygen. No RBCs means no oxygen transport.
So the symptoms are exactly what you'd expect.
Right. Fatigue, but not just tired. We're talking severe, crushing fatigue and hypoxia, shortness of breath. Maybe their heart rate is high, tachycardia, as the heart tries to pump faster to move the few RBCs that are left around the body.
Yeah, the treatment for that?
We can use epoetin alpha. You might know it by its brand name, Epogen. It stimulates the bone marrow to make more RBCs. It's actually the same hormone your kidneys make naturally, just in a drug form.
Okay, so that's the nadir and pancytopenia. That is the baseline safety knowledge for literally any chemo patient. Now let's shift gears a bit to the other major treatment modality, radiation therapy.
Radiation is interesting because the 50 rules depend entirely on where the radiation is coming from. Is it coming from a big machine outside the body? Or is it coming from a tiny implant that's been placed inside the body?
Two totally different sets of precautions.
Completely different.
Let's start with the more common one, external radiation or teletherapy, the beam.
The key concept here is skincare. That's what they test. Imagine the radiation beam like a highly concentrated, invisible ray of sun. It has to pass through the skin to hit the tumor underneath. So the skin at that entry site just takes a beating.
It looks like a really bad sunburn, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Dry, red, sometimes it even peels.
Exactly. And as nurses, when we see dry, red, irritated skin, what is our first instinct?
We want to soothe it. We want to wash it gently, put some lotion on it, maybe a cool pad.
And for the NCLEX, that is exactly what you should not do unless it is specifically prescribed by the radiation oncologist.
Why can't I put some gentle lotion on it? It seems so harmless.
Because many lotions, creams, or powders contain metals or chemicals that can actually enhance the radiation burn. It's something called the bolus effect. You can inadvertently make the burn much, much worse.
So no random lotions from the bedside table?
Yeah.
What about the markings they put on the patient's skin?
The radiologists draw these little targets on the patient's skin with special ink, or sometimes they give them tiny permanent tattoos. Do not wash those off.
Never.
Ever. That is their map. That's how they aim the beam precisely every single day. If you scrub off the marks, they can't aim the beam accurately, and they might hit healthy tissue.
So what would he do? Just leave the skin alone entirely?
Pretty much. Keep it clean and dry. If you wash the area, use lukewarm water and just your hand no washcloths. So that's way too abrasive. Pat it dry. Don't ever rub it. And you have to think about clothing.
I'm assuming no tight jeans over an abdominal radiation, say.
Exactly. Wear loose, soft clothing. Cotton is best. Avoid belts, buckles, or bra straps that rub directly against that treatment site. Friction is the enemy here.
And protecting it from the sun, I assume.
Absolutely. No direct sunlight on the radiation site, ever. And no other heat sources. No hot water bottles, no heating pads. The skin is already cooked. You don't want to cook it more.
Okay, that's external. Now let's talk about the one that feels like it's straight out of a sci-fi movie scenario. Internal radiation or brachytherapy?
This is a totally different ballgame. In external radiation, the patient is not radioactive. Once the machine turns off, they are perfectly safe to touch, to hug, whatever.
But in internal radiation?
In internal radiation, we are placing a sealed radioactive implant, like a seed or a ribbon, inside the patient's body. It's often used for cervical or prostate cancer.
So the patient is the hazard. They are emitting radiation from the inside out.
Exactly. The patient is radioactive. You, the nurse, your coworkers, the family, everyone is at risk of exposure.
So how do we stay safe? This feels really intimidating.
We follow the three cardinal rules, the safety triad: time, distance, and shielding.
Okay, let's break those down. First, time.
We need to limit our exposure time. The general guideline is a maximum of 30 minutes of direct close contact care per provider per 8-hour shift.
30 minutes is not a lot of time to get everything done.
It's not. So you have to be incredibly organized. You don't go in to chat about the weather for 20 minutes. You cluster your care. You go in, you check your vitals, give your meds, help with any immediate hygiene needs, and you get out.
Efficient. Okay, next is distance.
Radiation intensity drops off significantly with distance. It follows the inverse square law for any physics nerds out there. But basically, standing 6 feet away is vastly safer than standing 1 foot away.
So when you're not doing direct hands-on care, you should back away.
Right. If you're just asking them how they're feeling, stand at the doorway. Maximize that distance.
And finally, shielding.
You wear a lead apron. Lead is dense enough to block the radiation particles, and you absolutely must wear a dosimeter film badge.
What is that exactly? Okay. What does it do?
It looks like a little ID badge you clip to your collar. It contains a special film that reacts to radiation. Now, it doesn't protect you at all.
It's a measurement device.
It's a measurement device. It measures how much radiation you've been exposed to over time. It's a safety check to ensure you aren't exceeding the safe lifetime limits for a healthcare worker.
And there's a very strict rule about these badges on the exam, isn't there?
Yes. Do not share badges. Your dosimeter is assigned to you and you only. If you wear someone else's, the record of your exposure is completely useless and inaccurate.
What about visitors? Can family come in and see them?
There are really strict restrictions. No pregnant staff and no pregnant visitors ever. Radiation is teratogenic. It causes birth defects.
Okay.
No visitors under the age of 16. A child's cells are dividing so rapidly, they're far more susceptible to radiation damage. And visitors should limit their time to usually 30 minutes a day, and they need to stay 6 feet away.
No cuddling.
No cuddling. It's hard, but it's for their safety.
Now, here is the classic NCLEX disaster scenario for internal radiation. This shows up all the time in question banks. You walk into the room of a patient with a cervical implant. You look at the bed, and you see the implant.
Yeah.
It has fallen out. It's just lying there on the bed sheet.
Instant panic time.
Your first instinct is probably to grab it, right? To get it off the bed, stop it from burning the patient's leg.
That is the gut instinct, but it is absolutely the wrong move. Do not touch it with your bare hands. Ever.
What about gloves? Can I double glug it?
No. Standard latex or nitrile gloves do absolutely nothing to stop radiation. If you pick that up, you are giving your hand a massive concentrated dose of radiation.
So what do? I can't just leave it there.
You can't. You have to secure it. Every room with an internal radiation patient must have a specific safety kit kept in the room at all times.
And in that kit
are long-handled forceps and a lead-lined container, which is often called a pig.
Long-handled, that goes back to the distance part of the triad.
Exactly. You use the forceps, keeping your hand as far away as possible to pick up the implant, and you drop it into the lead container. You close the lid, then you call the radiation oncologist to report it.
That is a must-know safety procedure. Long-handled forceps, lead container, never bare hands.
Correct. You are protecting yourself from a very significant exposure.
Okay, let's move on from treatments to specific cancers. The exam tends to focus on a few specific types because they have very classic signs that make for really good test questions. Let's start with multiple myeloma.
Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the plasma cells. And plasma cells are a type of white blood cell that lives primarily in the bone marrow.
When I hear multiple myeloma, I want every student listening to immediately think of two things: bones breaking and high calcium.
That is the perfect association. In myeloma, these malignant plasma cells overgrow in the bone marrow, and they release these cytokines that actually tell the body to dissolve the bone around them.
They dissolve the bone, you mean like weaken it?
No, I mean literally dissolve it. On an X-ray, you can see these punched-out elytic lesions. The bone becomes like Swiss cheese. It's incredibly fragile.
So symptom number one in the classic tetrad of myeloma is bone pain.
Yes, usually in the ribs, the spine, and the pelvis. And because the bone is so weak, symptom number two is pathological fractures.
Pathological, meaning they break for no good reason.
Exactly. They aren't in a car accident. They are rolling over in bed or sneezing too hard, and they break a rib. So as a nurse, safety when removing them is absolutely paramount. You have to be so gentle.
Now let's follow the physiology here. If you're dissolving bone, what gets released into the blood?
Well, bone is your body's main storage unit for calcium. So if you break down the bone, you flood the blood with calcium, and that leads to symptom number three, hypercalcemia.
And finally, symptom number four, which involves the kidneys. This one's a little more obscure.
Bence-Jones proteins. These are these abnormal antibody fragments produced by the cancer cells. They show up in the urine, and they are notoriously toxic to the kidney tubules. They basically clog them up like sludge.
So we have a patient with bones like Swiss cheese, extremely high calcium in their blood, and kidneys that are being attacked by both proteins and calcium stones.
Okay.
What is our priority nursing intervention? It's surprisingly simple.
Hydration.
Just water.
Lots and lots of it. You need to push fluids. We're talking 2 to 3 liters a day, unless they have some kind of heart failure that contraindicates it.
Why is fluid the magic bullet here?
For two main reasons. One, it dilutes the high concentration of calcium in the blood, so it's less toxic to the body. And two, it creates a high flow rate through the kidneys to flush out those Bence-Jones proteins and prevent calcium stones from forming. You are literally flushing the pipes to keep them from clogging up and failing.
Hydration for myeloma. Got it. Okay, next up, leukemia.
Leukemia is a broad term, but for the NCLEX, you really just need to think of it as the overproduction of immature white blood cells.
This one always confuses students because they'll look at the lab report and the WBC count might be like 100,000. Normal is 5,000 to 10,000. So the student thinks, wow, their immune system must be super strong.
And that's the great paradox of leukemia. The count is incredibly high, but the cells are what we call blasts. They're baby cells. They don't know how to fight infection yet. They are totally useless. So despite this massive number, the patient is severely immunocompromised.
It's like having an army of toddlers instead of an army of trained soldiers.
That's a perfect analogy. And because the bone marrow is so crowded with these millions of useless toddler cells, there's no room to make the other important stuff.
Like red blood cells or platelets.
Right. So you go right back to our pancytopenia picture again. Even though their WBC count is high, they have anemia from low RBCs and thrombocytopenia from low platelets. So you see fatigue, bruising, bleeding gums, nosebleeds, all of that.
Let's do a quick touch on Hodgkin's lymphoma. What's the buzzer word for this one? The thing that differentiates it.
Reed-Sternberg cells. If the biopsy report says Reed-Sternberg cells are present, it is Hodgkin's lymphoma. If they're absent, it's non-Hodgkin's. It's the defining feature.
And clinically, what's the classic presentation?
Painless enlargement of lymph nodes, often in the neck, the cervical nodes. The patient finds a lump while they're shaving or putting on makeup, and the key word is painless.
Painless is key. If it hurt, it would most likely be an infection, right?
Correct, like a swollen gland from strep throat.
Mm-hmm.
They might also report what we call B symptoms, drenching night sweats, fevers, and unexplained weight loss.
Let's shift over to the pharmacology side. Chemotherapy administration. There's a very specific rule about how we calculate the dose. It's not just take two pills and call me in the morning.
No, chemo has what we call a narrow therapeutic index. A too much can be lethal, and a little too little doesn't kill the cancer. We need incredible precision. So we dose it based on total body surface area, or DSA.
Which means we need two numbers from the patient.
Their height and their weight. And here is the key nursing action that the NCLEX loves to test. You must obtain a current height and weight before every single administration.
Why every time? An adult's height isn't going to change.
True, but their weight can change drastically during cancer treatment. They might lose 10 pounds from nausea in just a week. If you use last week's weight to calculate the dose, you might overdose them significantly. Do not rely on patient word of mouth. You must put them on the scale.
Good point. Now let's talk safety during the infusion itself. You're hanging a vesicant chemo drug. The IV is running smoothly. The patient looks at you and says, "Hey, you know, that burns a little at my IV site."
Stop the infusion immediately.
Don't flush it. Don't slow it down. Don't call the doctor first.
No. Your hand moves to the roller clamp on the IV tubing and you shut it off. That is always the first action.
Why so aggressive? What's the risk?
The risk is extravasation. If that IV catheter has slipped out of the vein, that chemo drug is leaking into the surrounding tissue. Chemotherapy drugs are caustic, they're vesicants. They can cause tissue necrosis, the death of the tissue. If you let it keep running, that patient could lose function of their arm or even need skin grafts.
So stop the IV first, then assess, then call the provider.
That's the sequence, always.
Let's hit a couple of specific drug side effects that tend to show up on exams. First, etoposide.
Etoposide causes a very specific and testable reaction. Orthostatic hypotension.
That's the drop in blood pressure when you stand up, which makes you feel dizzy.
Right. But with etoposide, it can happen just during the infusion while they're lying in bed. So when you administer it, you have to do it slowly, usually over 30 to 60 minutes. And you absolutely must monitor their blood pressure frequently during that time.
Got it. What about tamoxifen? This one is huge for breast cancer.
Tamoxifen is an anti-estrogen. It works by blocking estrogen receptors on breast cancer cells. But, and this is the tricky part, it actually acts like estrogen in other parts of the body.
And what does estrogen do to our blood?
It makes it clot more easily. Just like birth control pills increase your risk of blood clots, tamoxifen increases the risk of deep vein thrombosis, DVT, and pulmonary embolism, PE.
So if a patient on tamoxifen suddenly says, my calf really hurts, or I'm feeling short of breath.
Your brain has to scream blood clot. You also have to watch their calcium levels. It can occasionally cause hypercalcemia, which is another thing to monitor.
Okay, we are arriving at probably the most high-stakes section of this deep dive, oncological emergencies. These are the priority questions. The patient is actively dying, and you have minutes to figure out why and what to do.
These are the questions where the answer is rarely document and monitor. The answer is always act now.
First one. Superior vena cava syndrome, or SVC syndrome. Let's visualize the anatomy for a second.
The superior vena cava, or SVC, is the main blood vessel, the main pipe, that drains all the deoxygenated blood from your head, your neck, and your arms back down into your heart.
Now imagine a tumor, usually from lung cancer, or a lymphoma in the chest growing right next to that pipe.
It pushes on it, it compresses it, and eventually it can block it off completely.
So the blood can't drain down. So where does it go?
It backs up, just like a clogged drain in your sink. The fluid backs up into the face, the neck, and the arms.
So the classic sign of the NCLEX is?
Facial edema, swelling of the face, especially in the morning after they've been lying flat all night. And the classic Stokes' sign of tightness of the shirt collar. The patient says, I can't button my top button anymore.
What else might you see?
Upper extremity edema. Their arms might be swollen. You might see distended neck veins. The patient often complains of a feeling of fullness in their head, like it's about to pop.
What is the priority nursing action?
Sit them up, immediately put them in a high Fowler's position, let gravity help drain some of that fluid down, give them oxygen to help with perfusion. But ultimately, this is a plumbing problem caused by a mass. They need radiation or chemo immediately to shrink that tumor and open the pipe back up.
Okay, next emergency, tumor lysis syndrome, or TLS.
This one is fascinating because it actually happens when the chemo works too well or too fast.
That sounds completely counterintuitive. How can a good thing be an emergency?
Think about it. You have a patient with, say, leukemia. They have billions of cancer cells circulating in their body. You hit them with a powerful dose of chemo, and suddenly, millions of those cells die and burst open all at once.
They lays.
Exactly, they lies. And whatever was inside those cells gets dumped directly into the bloodstream.
And what's inside a cell? A lot of stuff that shouldn't be in the blood in high concentrations.
Right. Potassium, phosphate, and the breakdown products of DNA, which is uric acid.
So suddenly the blood is just flooded with all these intracellular contents. Let's walk through the lab values.
You get profound hyperkalemia, high potassium. That's the big immediate killer because it causes cardiac arrhythmias.
Then you get hyperuricemia, high uric acid.
And uric acid forms sharp little crystals. Those crystals lodge in the kidneys and cause acute renal failure.
And you also get hyperphosphatemia, high phosphate. And this is where that seesaw effect comes into play.
Right. Phosphate and calcium are enemies in the blood. If phosphate goes way up, calcium goes way down. So you also develop hypocalcemia.
So the tumor lysis syndrome lab combo to memorize is high potassium, high uric acid, high phosphate, and low calcium.
That's the profile.
Perfect. And how do we treat this metabolic chaos?
Hydration. Again, we need to dilute this toxic sludge and try to flush the kidneys. We give a drug called allopurinol that specifically lowers uric acid levels to protect the kidneys. And for the high potassium, we treat it like any other hyperkalemia. Maybe give some glucose and insulin to drive the potassium back into the cells, or chiaxylate to help excrete it.
Third emergency, hypercalcemia. We mentioned this with multiple myeloma, but it can happen with other cancers too, especially with bone metastasis.
Normal calcium is roughly 8.5 to 10.5. If you see levels rising above 10.5, and definitely if they hit 12 or more, that is a medical emergency.
What's the old mnemonic for the signs of hypercalcemia?
The rhyme is groans, moans, bones, and stones.
Can you translate that for us?
Groans refers to constipation. Moans are psychiatric. Moans, lethargy, confusion, depression. Bones for the bone pain. And stones for kidney stones. But the big nursing assessment finding is profound muscle weakness and fatigue. They are just floppy. And you'll see changes on their EKG.
Finally, our last emergency, spinal cord compression.
This is exactly what it sounds like. A tumor, usually a metastasis in the spine, is pressing on the spinal cord itself. It's a mechanical compression.
And what is the absolute key warning sign for this?
New onset numbness or tingling in the lower extremities, or an intense localized back pain that gets worse when they're lying down.
So if a cancer patient says, my legs feel numb or my feet feel heavy and weak, you do not assume it's just diabetic neuropathy or a chemo side effect.
You cannot make that assumption. You have to assume it's spinal cord compression until it's proven otherwise. If you wait, they could become permanently paralyzed within hours. This requires immediate action high-dose steroids to reduce the swelling around the cord, and then urgent radiation or surgery.
All right, that was a lot of heavy high-stakes pathology. We've covered the blood counts, radiation safety, specific cancers, and the big emergencies. Now let's see if you can apply it.
It is time for our rapid-fire checkpoints.
Here's how this works. I'm going to give you a clinical scenario, just like an NCLEX question stem. I'll pause for just a second to let you think of the answer. Then our expert will break it down. Ready?
Let's do it.
Question one. You have a patient with multiple myeloma complaining of back pain. Their lab report comes back showing a serum calcium level of 12. Aside from medication, what is your priority non-pharmacological intervention?
The answer is encourage fluid intake, up to 3 liters a day.
The high calcium puts them at immediate risk for renal failure and kidney stones. Fluids are critical to dilute the serum calcium and help excrete it through the kidneys. It's that flush the pipes concept we talked about.
Excellent. Question two. You're the nurse for a patient with an internal radiation implant for cervical cancer. The patient calls out, and you enter the room to find the implant has dislodged and fallen onto the bed sheets. What is your immediate action?
The answer is, use a long-handled forceps from the room's safety kit to pick it up and place it in the lead-lined container.
Never touch a radioactive source with bare hands or even standard gloves. You must use the principles of distance and shielding to protect yourself while securing the source.
Perfect. Question three. A client on chemotherapy has a platelet count of 45,000. They have a headache and ask for an aspirin. How do you respond?
The answer is you would not give the aspirin. You would offer acetaminophen or Tylenol instead.
Aspirin inhibits platelet aggregation. It stops platelets from clumping together. With a count of 45,000, the patient is already on bleeding precautions. Giving them aspirin would drastically increase their risk of a serious hemorrhage.
Last one, question four. You are preparing to administer fidavetoposide to a patient with lung cancer. Which vital sign must be monitored specifically for this drug during the infusion?
The answer is blood pressure.
Etoposide is well known to cause significant orthostatic hypotension and general hypotension during the infusion. You have to administer it slowly and keep a close eye on that BP cuff.
Excellent job if you got those right. And if you missed one, that's okay. That is exactly why we're reviewing. Now, let's bring it all home with a recap. This is the Don't Forget This List for Test Day.
Okay, here are the top five takeaways from today's deep dive.
Infection is the silent killer. In a post-chemo patient, the usual signs of infection are often missing. A fever of 100.4 or even 99.5 with malaise is a full-blown emergency. Neutrophils less than 18% means strict isolation. No fresh flowers, no fresh fruit.
Number two, bleeding risk. Watch those platelets. Below 50,000 means precautions are on soft toothbrush, no IM shots, electric razor. Below 20,000 is spontaneous bleeding risk and no rectal temps ever.
Number three, radiation safety. Remember that triad. Time, limit your exposure to 30 minutes. Distance, stay 6 feet away when possible. And shielding, wear the lead apron and your dosimeter badge. And for external radiation, don't wash off those markings.
Number four, multiple myeloma. I want you to hear that and immediately think bone breakage and high calcium. The priority intervention is almost always hydration to save those kidneys.
And number five, oncological emergencies. You have to know the difference between SVC syndrome, the facial edema and tight collar, and spinal cord compression, the numb legs. And please, memorize that tumor lysis syndrome lab combo: high uric acid, high potassium, high phosphate, and low calcium.
Oncology is a heavy topic. It's emotionally heavy because of the nature of the illness, and it's intellectually heavy because of all this complex physiology. If you feel like your brain is completely full right now, that is normal.
Absolutely. But remember, you don't need to be an oncologist to pass the NCLEX. You just need to be a safe nurse. The exam is testing your safety radar, above all else. Can you spot the patient who is about to get an infection? Can you stop the patient from bleeding out? If you focus on safety, you will pass.
If these mnemonics and breakdowns helped you today, head over to nursingnotes.org. We are the first and only resource that uses music-powered learning to help these ranges like platelet counts and radiation rules actually stick in your head without all the stress of rote memorization. We've got AI tools and resources built by nurses who have stood exactly where you're standing right now.
Keep working hard. Trust the process. You can do this.
This is ConceptCast, signing off. Stay safe out there.